Coming up in This Week in Computer Hardware, AMD's Radeon Pro Duo. We got a preview. The FBI, they're keeping that Apple hack secret. Some killer $500 PC builds, Acer's liquid-cooled tablet, and more. It's all coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twitch.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 361, recorded April 28th, 2016. Is AMD's supercard too late?
This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by IT Pro TV. IT Pro TV is an easy, entertaining approach to online IT training. For a free 7-day trial and 30% off the life of your account, go to itpro.tv/Twitch and use code TWITCH30.
Welcome to Twitch This Week in Computer Hardware, Twitch weekly show that aims to bring you the most useful, most informative, most delightful, and occasionally most peanut butter-filled hardware news available in the universe. I say some peanut butter, so it's on my mind. We love mobile phones. We love laptops. We love desktops. And it's a good week to talk about desktops. I just got done doing a $500 PC build, and ZOMG, it is amazing how much hardware you can get for $500 and how much more processor you can get if you don't game. But I should probably take a moment to introduce the man, the myth, the benchmarking lesson. You're a benchmarking lesson. Ryan Trout, ladies and gentlemen. Since I'm not capable of speaking, I'm going to stop speaking now.
I mean,
oh my goodness.
I try to educate. So I think lesson is a, I don't know about me being a singular, you know, noun of that, but worth.
You are a lesson, sir. You really are. I don't know. I'm was looking at parts and PC parts picker because I was, you know, I had this, I've got that $40, you know, ECS H81H3 Haswell motherboard that I learned about from you guys when we did that $400 PC build. And, you know, I built like a Core i3 system around that and, you know, a 950 GTX, and then turned around and realized, wow, you know, you can get 8 gigabytes of DDR4 now for $27. You can get a gigabyte 1151 motherboard for $56. It's amazing how much Skylake has fallen in the last few weeks, but we will talk about that in a moment. The Radeon Pro Duo has been previewed. Or, as you like to say, the final details have been leaked. How glorious is the leak, sir?
Well, now it's actually official. It's not really just a leak anymore. So you gotta go with what it was. So the it was officially announced. It's such a complicated story because the dual Fuji card was shown last June at E3,
right.
And kind of in the October-ish time frame is when we told it was going to be available initially. And then in October, they said, actually, it's going to be Q2. And then at GDC in March, they announced it as the Radeon Pro Duo. They announced the brand for it. They announced the price at $1,499. They talked about it was two Fiji GPUs. And really, they didn't do much more than that today, other than the fact that it's now listed on Newegg. It was already sold out, or maybe it was never actually for sale. But it was listed. It came out with, you know, here's the clock speeds, here's the estimated performance numbers, here's some comparison points to other cards. Mm-hmm. You know, it's an impressive product if you look at it in specs. 8,192 GPU cores or shader processors or stream processors or whatever you want to call them. That's essentially, you're essentially looking at two R9 Fury or R9 Nano GPUs, I guess, merged onto one PCB. So you get, you know, double the GPU cores, double the memory, double the ROPs, double the texture units, all that type of stuff that is important. But it's always, obviously, you're not talking about one GPU with all that capability. You're talking about, you know, two GPUs on the same board. You're running the equivalent of two Radeon R9 Nanos in Crossfire on this board pretty much full time, right? So you get 8 gigs of memory, but it's 4 gigs of HBM rated for each of the two GPUs. You've got exactly double the TDP. It goes from 175 watts of a Nano to 350. For the Radeon Pro Duo, you get twice the number of compute, 16.38 teraflops of compute, which is obviously...
teraflops.
Yeah. And it does have a steep price tag of $1,499, which you can
see
You could buy three R9 Nanos for the price of one Radeon Pro Duo, but you know there's obviously trade-offs with that. This is a two-slot card with a water block attached. And if you look actually at the next picture down, you can get a little idea of kind of how the card is designed, right? There's two physical water pumps on one on each GPU. You can see how the liquid is kind of between the GPUs back to the single. It's a single 120 millimeter, but like double rad, double thick rad on it. You get an idea of the performance there as well. They talk about it being 1.5x the performance of the GTX Titan X, 1.3 of the 295X2, I guess.
where are they getting the 1.5x? I'm looking at the world's fastest graphics. I'm looking at 4K gaming performance. Yeah. Rise of the Tomb Raider, you're going from like 30-something to 40-something frames. I mean, it's very loose. Like GTA 5, 50 frames per second out of the Titan, and then 85 frames per second out of the Radeon Pro Duo. Because, you know, I personally find GTA 5 unusable at less than 70 frames per second. Cue humor. This is a lot of money for it. I mean, because we can't really use, if you're doing VR, we can't really use Crossfire or SLI currently, correct?
No, right? Yeah, it's not really supported. It has to be on a per game basis, and nothing really today really uses multi-GPU. But the same is true for the DirectX as well, with the exception of Ashes of the Singularity, which has integrated multi-GPU into its engine. Actual DirectX 12 gaming is multi-GPU either.
You know, but so who's...
sense of where it does.
I mean, you know, is there enough margin on this card where it can be, you know, like the mini, you know, where there's enough... There's a small but deep-pocketed segment of the GPU buying audience that's going to look at this and go, this is the card I was waiting for, because... So I don't know. It just doesn't seem like a huge jump over the R9 295X2, but R9 a lot more money.
R9 is it launched at $1,500.
Okay.
Fastest graphics card in the world when it launched. But it was this has a TDP of 350. The TDP of the 295X2 was 500 watts. So it's significantly more, right? Which is worth pointing out. But it's interesting because if you look down, I think it's a slide maybe above that one that you're looking at or two above, where they talk about choose from a blend of gamer and professional drivers. They're releasing two drivers for this. One is the Radeon Crimson version driver. One is the AMD Fire Pro driver. And this whole product has undergone this transformation. When they talked about it in June, last June at E3, they talked about it being the ultimate card for gamers who create and creators who game in like this kind of semi-professional or, you know, super enthusiast person that maybe does a little bit of both. And it was really targeted. This is like the ultimate for gamers, but we realize it's very expensive. So it's also very useful for people that are doing creation or you're doing compute or you're doing something. You just need a whole lot of GPU horsepower. In March, when they talked about it, they very much talked about it as a developer card. One for people who are developing VR games that want to have two GPUs in their system so they can learn how to develop multi-GPU VR or DX12 for that matter. And they kind of downplayed the gaming side of it. But even at that point, the product manager for this said, oh, yeah, no, we're going to send out samples. You're going to do reviews. It's going to be like a normal card launch. Well, as it turned out, on Tuesday, there were no reviews of the product. AMD did not send out cards for review to media, as they typically have done, what they did with the 295X2 and all these, you know, cards beforehand, because they were like, you know what, as it turns out, we're not really aiming this towards the gaming market because, you know, of these potential issues, right? And I think the major issues for it are the DirectX and the VR are the current hot things in gaming on the PC. And this card, because it depends on multi-GPU support to get its performance, can't really shine in that light, right? But to the same degree, if you look at the slides on there, the ones you were pointing out where they show Rise of the Tomb Raider, GTA 5, Battlefield 4, Assassin's Creed, Far Cry Primal, like they're showing gaming benchmarks, right? And they're calling it the world's fastest graphics card for 4K gaming performance, right? So they're kind of talking out of both sides in regard to the launch. So
we don't want to seed $25,000 or $50,000 or $100,000 worth of GPUs to get the word out. We just want people to know that this, it's a curious product. It's a curious launch.
I actually got one in, for me, and went through a whole bunch of. I've got it sitting right here in front of me right now, actually. So like, this is the card. It looks like the other, the Radeon Fury X and cards with the integrated water cooler. It's a nice build quality. It's an impressive piece of hardware. I got one in from another source, basically to do the review. Which I'm hoping to have up on Friday of this week if I can get through all the testing and stuff I need to get done. But, I think AMD kind of knows what the conclusion to all these stories are. And especially if they come out and say, we're not selling this to gamers. Like my conclusion or review will already be, oh, this is not for gamers, but it's for the crazy person out there that maybe wants it. And you got to think, like, we know Polaris is coming, right? We know Polaris is going to be here in June, right? AMD has said that our next generation architecture, this is based on Fiji, their previous generation architecture. So another reason why it may seem old or appear to be old, right? Technology, even though this will still be AMD's highest performing graphics card for probably some time to come, many, many months, not longer, because of how Polaris is being built and what kind of performance targets they're trying to hit with those first generation of GPUs. So we'll have a review of it, and we'll have, numbers that people can reference and things that they can look at. And, it still depends on multi-GPU. So is it going to be fast? Yes. Is it going to be maybe less ideal than, even a higher end, like a $650 980 Ti card or even a Fury X, because those are single GPU components? I think, obviously, the answer is going to be yes to that. I have run all the data I'm going to run. I just need to compile it and do the write up. But it's going to be, I think, in the same vein with the 295X2. This was, hey, if you're a crazy person and you just want the ultimate best, fastest possible thing, this is the product you can get. But the problem is the ecosystem has changed around AMD to the point where back then multi GPU was kind of getting better. Right. Like AMD had fixed all of its testing issues that, we found years ago, and they were making the case that, hey, look, this card is actually good now. And now, thanks to DirectX 12 and VR, multi-GPU is kind of going back down a little bit in terms of its usefulness. It will go back up again. I have every indication that it will go back up again, but it's just kind of coming out at the wrong time to be seen.
Right. This would have been so perfect 12 to 18 months ago.
I mean, had they launched it last June when they launched the other products, then it had a useful lifespan, right? It would have been like, oh, okay, here is this, right? You want the ultimate in performance. This is it. I they don't plan on selling a whole lot of these, would be my guess. They've already built these boards. Chances are they got a warehouse with several boxes, these boards already built up and these coolers paid for and designed and all that stuff. It's like, well, we got to try to sell it to somebody. Delaying it any longer is not going to help the process. They're not going to be able to wait for, these VR developers and game engines to suddenly catch up. So it's an interesting product. I don't recommend anybody wait for this to come in stock and actually buy it unless you have a very specific need for what it does. But I don't think there's a whole lot of consumers that will be out there for it. But it's a neat product. It's just too late. Too late for it to be neat enough to buy, I guess.
Well, there you have it. It's just like, ouch. I don't know. It's frustrating when a product comes a little bit later than it needs to. But technically, it is the fastest under these particularly narrow circumstances. Speaking of magic circumstances, obviously the Apple FBI, FURA, the fight for your privacy or the fight to protect terrorists, depending on your political and or personal points of view, ended a few weeks ago when the FBI announced that they had a crack. A third party source had given them an in to the iPhone in question. And it's interesting to me to find out a few weeks later, right? We know that they paid $1.3 million for it. And the FBI has basically said, there's articles over it, the one we have a link to is from the Wall Street Journal, that they are not going to tell Apple what the zero-day vulnerability is, possibly because they did not purchase the rights to the zero-day flaw, which means that if somebody else has $1 million for the zero-day flaw, then they can pay the million or $1.3 million and get it. Or presumably it will start to leak out of the FBI eventually at some point. It would be nice if it stayed private, but I don't know if that will happen. But, I thought it was interesting because there was they were trying to do a review of it. It's funny to watch, as the administration is trying to up America's cybersecurity game, the FBI is buying zero-day exploits and then not telling the vendor how to fix the zero-day exploit because they want that access to iPhones in criminal cases. It's an interesting conundrum. Director Comfey, who was saying last week or the week before, he had pointed out how, he wants, as a private citizen, he's like, he puts tape over his webcam on his laptop to help prevent spying. He wants the citizens to sort of monitor the police to make sure there's oversight and that privacy and civil rights are upheld. But on the flip side, he says things like, in this quote, Director Comey says to the Wall Street Journal, the FBI is whether the FBI is, quote, aware of a vulnerability, or did we just buy a tool and don't have sufficient knowledge of the vulnerability, end quote, to launch the White House Vulnerability Equities Process, which is the policy it uses to decide whether to disclose details of security flaws. So the idea is that if they find out about flaws, they're supposed to work with the vendor to patch the flaw to make America more secure, except when they apparently don't want to or did not pay the extra VIG. Maybe it would have been $1.7 million to actually have full knowledge of the flaw. Maybe it's a magic tool, but, it's messy. It's going to continue to be messy. On the upside, the House passed a bill this week that says basically you will have to get a warrant to access email. So, while we are having, various government agencies that are basically trying to hack all the things and save all the things and look at all the things, at least within the context of what their agencies do, we do finally have some activity in our legislature that is moving to protect some level of privacy and to put some curbs on the gathering of all of the data on the internet. I don't know. It's something I thought was worth saying, worth mentioning, and I don't know if there's a lot to talk about it, but I just love the idea that the FBI is basically buying vulnerabilities and keeping them secret, or as secret as they can.
Yeah, it's a little odd.
It's a little odd. Oh my goodness, this is a pretty case. NZXT Mantis Mini ITX enclosure. Just because a case is pretty doesn't mean it's good. How'd this one hold up?
It's an interesting design, right? Because some of these, like that first picture there is like a stock photo from NZXT. It kind of looks like it was photographed in a fisheye lens, right?
Does it actually bulge like that in real life?
A little bit. Like the next shot down shows an exploded view where you can see all the different like the radiator configurations. Like you can put a 240 rad up top, 240 rad in the up top and in the front on this case. And this is a mini ITX chassis, right? Keep that in mind. And if you look down, if you start to scroll through the other photos, you'll see like that one that kind of shows the corner. There is a bend to it. There is kind of a bulge to the design. That is really just, and actually scroll down a couple of more, you'll see like one from the front that the next one down actually shows it looks worse than it may actually be. Like, it's from some angles, it will look really kind of skewed. But in reality, it's not nearly that bad. You can kind of see how much the sides come out there. And it's purely a aesthetics kind of look and style and feel. The next shot down shows you the same view from the back. Now, on the back of the case, there's some function to it because, like, hey, you know, your cables have a little bit more room to be packed into the back for cable routing. But on the front, I mean, it's covered in a window. It's purely for looks, right? On the side panel there. It's called the Manta. If you look down at like a couple of shots, there's like the view of the angles or the lines along the top of the case. You can kind of clearly see where they get the Manta aesthetics for. In terms of its functionality, it's got fan filters. It's got really, really high build quality. Sebastian was talking that up quite a bit in terms of just everything feels high quality, kind of has a normal NZXT fit and finish that we're frequently seeing with their cases. You know, things like the inside of it, portions of it are painted red that kind of match the striping you see on the outside. Right. So as you look in through the window, right, you see some red striping, you see some of the red backplane, and it kind of all works together that way. And I think it's neat. And they do that in other cases, to be sure. The case is really big for a mini ITX case, or for mini ITX motherboard, I guess. If you look on the last page where the completed build is, you can see that you know, the motherboard takes up not very much room at all. And what you get out of that is the ability to, that shot right there, like the red vertical section you see that has the NZXT logo on it is the end of the motherboard. Like the motherboard stops before it gets to that. But, you know, you can front mount your SSDs. So that's, you know, with the window, you can see a little bit there. Your power supply and everything is in the compartment below. So it performs pretty well. You can see on the back that the cable routing is adequate, you know, and again, it's behind a case or so, whatever, you know, not a big deal. It's got a light on the back of it for where the your external connections are, your USB ports and that kind of thing, which is nice if it's, you know, you're in a darkly lit room or you're kind of in a corner or you live in a cave or whatever it is, you can actually see to plug in your USB ports and your network ports and all that type of stuff. Temperature wise, it actually performed very well, beating out some of the or coming basically in line with what you see in the Fantex Evolve ITX Corsair Carbide 400C. GPU temperatures were really good. The noise levels were adequate, again, kind of in line with the competitive products, the Evolve ITX and the Carbide 400C. It's $139, so it's a little bit pricey. And it's really, you know, structurally, it's just a large mini ITX case.
Right.
There's nothing kind of unique about the design of how you would build inside of it necessarily. So it's really down to the idea of aesthetics. Do you like the way this case looks? Do you like the fact that it's not, you know, perfectly straight lines everywhere? I kind of think it actually looks pretty neat. I haven't seen it in person. I may have Sebastian bring it next time he comes down. The only weaknesses he saw was that it was large for mini ITX enclosure. So if you're building a mini ITX platform, your primary goal may be to get a small system. This kind of goes against some of that. And also GPU temps and the fans run high due to limited clearance. And if you look at the shot of the build again, you'll see that the GPU cooler is kind of not very far above the power supply clearance there. Yeah, there you go, in that shot there. So it's drawing air in, so the fans either have to spin a little bit faster to keep the GPU as cool as it would normally be. But he liked it a lot. No compromise, smaller build type product, I guess, but you gotta like the way it looks, and you gotta like the way it looks in order to make up for the fact that it's a big mini ITX case, which, you know, is a little bit counterintuitive.
Oh my goodness, that's frustrating. So we're talking a couple minutes ago about $500 PCs. I don't know if you can see those two PC parts picker links, Ryan, but it was fascinating to me how quickly prices have dropped. Because I was looking for something that would be an upgrade from the G3220, the dual core Pentium that I had run in my $400 gaming PC. You know, 8 gigabytes of RAM, you know, a GTX 950 they're selling for $140 now, 500 watt power supply, super basic system. Unlike the last couple of builds I did, this one actually includes the $85, or actually it was $85 this morning. This afternoon it's $80 for Microsoft Windows 10 Home OEM. And it was interesting to me because looking at like the Core i3-4160, which I paired up with the ECS H81H3, which is a motherboard I learned about when you guys did your bargain GPUs. You know, I probably, you know, in that price range, it's probably in a lot of ways more compelling to use AMD, but I don't see a good upgrade path for AMD, so I stuck with Intel. But it was amazing to me, like, you know, a Core i3-6100 and a Core i3-4160 are pretty much in parity price-wise. You know, a Gigabyte H1110 MA micro ATX motherboard, you know, they're selling for $56 now, $51 after a rebate. DDR4 is pretty much in parity with DDR3 in terms of pricing. It was interesting, you know, it was also, especially if you're looking at single core performance, there's not a huge difference between a Skylake and a Haswell GPU.
No.
You know, it was, you know, it's also amazing how cheap a Core i3 is. You're looking at like $110. Now it's, you know, it's hyper threaded. So it's four threads, two cores, which is certainly a step up from a dual core, no thread, or dual core, two thread machine. But I don't know. You see any holes, any flaws in my logic there? I should also point it out, because we were going to a price, we basically told people to just buy the cheapest case, or buy an ATX case at a yard sale or Goodwill.
No, all this seems pretty. This all seems pretty good, right? I mean, for the budget you set for it, that's pretty compelling. Like, you could. On the processor side, I know there are people that will say, "Oh, you know, there are some AMD processors you can get for like $75 that will work as well as the Core i3 4160." And there's probably some validity to that, but I'm kind of with you, and like I just think that's the better platform longer term, right? Once AMD comes out with new options, if the new architecture, you maybe make that argument. Okay, we've got room to grow on that one. But yeah, this would be a pretty good $500 bill for sure. Damn that Windows 10 for being $80. It's like the second most expensive product in the building.
Well, that's one of the things
they don't sell the free with Bing to consumers, do they? That's only an OEM product, right?
As far as I know, yeah, it's. You know, it's who knows? Maybe I can inspire a $500 leaderboard system. I was shocked though. Like DDR4 has settled in price. You know, the Skylakes have settled in price. You know, they're not that expensive. And I was kind of amazed at how much computer you get for $500. You know, probably $530 if you want to, you know, go out and buy a case. Be civil, you know, $550 if you want to buy a quieter CPU cooler rather than using the stock Intel cooler, which ironically I did not realize you could buy separately for $9. if you want the cheapest possible cooler and there's not one in the box. It was interesting. I just wanted to talk to people about that. And also before anybody says like, you only have one stick of memory. Well, in straight memory benchmarking tests, running dual channel versus single channel makes a difference. And everything I've seen so far, running a single channel of memory does not have any meaningful impact on gaming or everyday computing performance. So for me to lead an upgrade path for an inexpensive PC, I want to have an upgrade path moving forward. It's like, okay, I can buy another stick of memory when I have more money. Is there a chance to upgrade a CPU in 3 years when there's going to be a big jump? Like, if you're not going to get like a 50% performance improvement, I find it difficult to justify for home use a CPU upgrade. You know, in the work environment, if that means, you know, a 25% reduction in rendering time for a video, that might make it much more compelling. Or if you can complete, you know, Photoshop or video projects that much faster. But yeah, there's something I was thinking about. Just amazing how much computer you can get right now for not a lot of money. So if you guys have thoughts on that, feel free to tweet at Patrick Norton or at Ryan Shrout.
Very cool.
Man. Very cool. Thank you. Thank you very much. Hey, we should take a moment to thank our sponsor for this episode of Twitch, which is brought to you by IT Pro TV. IT changes daily, people. It changes constantly. It seems like it changes minute by minute on the bad days. A good IT pro is constantly learning and staying up to date with current technology certifications, which is where IT Pro TV comes in. They have high-quality video tutorials. They're not only going to keep your IT skills current, but they're going to bring you closer to achieving that new IT job you've been working towards. They literally have 1,000 hours of content. New courses are added weekly. You can stream their courses live and on demand worldwide to your Chromecast, Roku, Amazon, Fire TV, Apple TV, or PC. You can learn on the go with your mobile devices. Course topics include Microsoft Server 2016 MCSE, CCNP Security, CCNA Routing and Switching, SSH, Azure SQL, Cryptography, Home Router Configuration, I want to take that one, and more. They got 100-plus step-by-step virtual machine labs and Transcender practice exams. That's a $109 value. Which basically means, you know, if you don't want to have to set up a server or rent time on a server or build a server, you know, to work through your projects, they have virtual machine labs to make it possible for you, make it easy. One low monthly subscription price, the no-hassle cancellation policy, transcripts let you follow from start to finish or jump right to any part of the video. Corporate and group pricing is available. The clients list, it's pretty slick. Harvard, MIT, UCSD, Stanford. And more. Do yourself a favor. If you want to get ahead in your career in IT, go to itpro.tv/twitch. That's itpro.tv/twych to upgrade your brain with the most popular IT certifications. Premium subscriptions are normally $57 a month. They're $570 a year. But we have a special offer. Try it free for 7 days when you sign up using our code TWITCH30 to check out their courses, live stream, and more. You'll also receive 30% off for the lifetime of your account. That's less than $40 a month or $399 for the entire year. 30% is a big discount, people. itpro.tv/twych. Use the code TWITCH30 to try it free for 7 days and save 30%. Hey, if you've never seen it, go check it out. They got a lot of good stuff up there. And we want to thank IT Pro TV for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware.
For sure.
Home router configuration. Yes. Router configuration is getting miserable or just, you know, changes just enough across all the different vendors to make it, you know, just leave you confused and less than delighted. I remember one of the most fascinating things I ever read was the idea that, you know, no plane company would ever license the cord or the wing design, no major airplane manufacturer, you know, to Korea or China or anywhere else, because that's where the money is. That's where the engineering value is. That's where the IP property is, or, the, you know, the core of the value of their intellectual property. And I thought it was interesting that AMD is now licensing their server processor technology to Chinese companies. What's that mean long term for AMD? Just another revenue stream?
So long term for them, it's interesting in that it could be their foothold into the Chinese market at all, right? And obviously there's a huge potential there, right? Short term, they get a little bit of influx of cash. I think they were given like $260 million or something like that for their part of to like license the IP and to join into this joint venture type stuff. So that's kind of like an initial shot in the arm. But I think the idea is they'll continue to get royalties based on these vendors building processors that they then sell inside the Chinese market. Very similar to how like the ARM business model works, right? Where right. ARM gets paid every time Qualcomm sells a processor, even though Qualcomm built the CPU, it just happens to use ARM's IP in it. It'd be the same here for AMD. And it's an interesting kind of workaround to the idea that you're not allowed to sell x86 processors to the Chinese government. I think that was something that the U.S. government decided a couple of years ago, right? Right. Put some restrictions on it, essentially. And you can't, in AMD's cross-licensing deal with Intel for the x86 part, says they can't sell their license to anybody else. But apparently, I'm sure there are a lot of lawyers at AMD that looked all this stuff up and they did a whole lot of research, but they could, if they were part of a consortium to license it and be part of that group, that this is somehow their way to be able to make some additional money off of the x86 IP-based IP that they have and hopefully, you know, sell a bunch of processors, get a whole bunch of royalties and get an influx of cash flow for them from not just the Chinese government. I'm sure the Chinese government will do some of that. Companies that are going to build processors for the growing, you know, kind of cloud infrastructure that will have to exist in China as more and more of those people become connected on the internet.
So many connections.
There will be a ton.
Connect all the things, people. It's inevitable. NVIDIA GP104 die picture. GTX 1080 does not use HBM. There you have it. Video cards, a.k.a. overclock.net/chiphell. High-quality images apparently have been leaked of the upcoming GP104 die, writes Sebastian up on PCPro.com. That is, of course, expected to power the GeForce GTX 1070 graphics card. There you look. Qualification sample there. Quote, this GP104-200 variant is supposedly planned for GTX 1070, although it is a cut-down version of the GP104-400. Both GPUs will look exactly the same, the only difference being a modified GPU configuration. This high-quality picture is perfect material for comparison if you're into staring at, you know, chips. look, it's a heat spreader. Look, it's PCB. Look, little tiny resistors. The leaker says that the GTX 1080 will feature GDDR5X memory, while the GTX 1070 will stick to GDDR5, both using a 256-bit memory bus. Cards based on the GP104 GPU are to be equipped with 3 display ports, HDMI, and DVI. Does this mean there's going to be another set of chips coming out? Well, I mean, obviously, or just that HBM is only going to be in the Pascal ports?
Well, what I think this means is HBM2 will only be in the super high end Pascal parts, right? So okay. GP100 that was announced at the NVIDIA's conference a few weeks ago that was going to go in this high end Tesla part. Does use HBM2, but it's an expensive thing, and you have to make a decision. Either your GPU is going to use HBM2 or it's not, right? You can't have a memory controller that really works both ways, as it turns out. So it would appear that GP104, which is what the GTX 1080, if that's what it's called, will ship as, will use GDDR5 or GDDR5X, which is probably, like, it's fine, right? The benefits of HBM for Fiji were impressive, but the limitation of 4 gigabytes hurt them a lot. And it wasn't that much better. It helped in efficiency. It helped in space and roominess in terms of what your board design could be. But it didn't fundamentally change the architecture, right, yet, until the GPUs become a little bit more powerful to take advantage of the extra bandwidth. It's kind of like a bouncing back and forth game. I think a lot of it has to do with availability of HBM, yields of that, cost of that, and it kind of makes sense because it looks like GP104 is going to use, and all the ones under that, will use GDDR5 of some kind, and we expect Polaris to use GDDR5 as well in its initial rounds. So we may be a little bit before we see more consumer HBM, high bandwidth memory based products.
So don't hold your breath.
Not yet.
That seems reasonable. Oh, my goodness. The fastest switch in the West. Corsair and Cherry revealed the Cherry MX Speed Switch. Did we talk about this last week? I think we may have talked a little bit about it. We did a review this week
we did. It was on there for last week. I apologize.
Well, you hadn't had your hands-on time with it. You hadn't had your personal gentleman's time. I was laughing because, you know, there's nothing's going to, no keyboard, no matter how fast, is going to fix my relationship to Counter-Strike or any other first person shooter. I did like it a lot for typing, although the sort of cupped textures, they have like the pull off keys so you can swap the WASD key for these gray textured keys that kind of create a cup shape there. I could not type normally on the machine with those in place. It was interesting. Shannon found it a little frustrating. Her husband's actually a serious first person shooter enthusiast, and he found that the shorter key path, right, because it's 1.2 millimeter instead of like 1.9 would be more typical, which is, 2 mil, it's a little over a millimeter, 1.2 millimeters, is not a lot of key travel to make the contact. If you haven't looked at a millimeter in a while, you know, go look at a millimeter. It's not a lot of distance. I thought it was great for typing. You know, it didn't really help out my gaming, but there is no helping for my gaming, except for maybe selling the children and going into some sort of gaming monastery. The build quality is fantastic. I like the you know, I'm not a bling guy on computers, but I do actually like the RGB keyboards. I think making the keys white underneath to reflect more of the light down on the keyboard makes a pretty healthy difference in terms of the looks of the thing. The programming software has gotten a lot better. What did you think? Since obviously I apparently felt the need to say everything I said last week over again.
So the one thing I'll say about having it in person here in the office the first time is that there's a difference between key travel and key actuation. Like, it still bottoms out at the same as like a Cherry Red. Both Ken and Alan used it. That's kind of the first thing they said, is it feels like a Cherry Red. And there's no indication, if you have the keyboard unplugged, for example, there's no indication that you are hitting the switch earlier than you would otherwise. It doesn't feel like, you don't feel like a notch or a click or anything in it from that. Alan even pointed out, like, if you're a bad typer, it may be like if you kind of often will accidentally barely touch a side key, right, to the one you're actually attempting to hit, that instant, nearly instant actuation of the switch may actually be a negative for you for typing, right? But it's intended for gaming, right? It's supposed to be rapid fire, fastest switch in the West, as Jeremy wrote in our story, right? For instantaneous reaction times. So I haven't spent enough time with it in terms of a typing environment to see if that has actually affected me. But I could see that being a potential drawback for people that type, that may not type with the most consistent keystrokes.
No, I'm laughing because, you know, at one point I could type well over, you know, 80, 85 words per minute, which requires you to be fundamentally accurate and not look at the keyboard. But it's for me as a touch typist, there were zero issues with that. With some friends of mine who like to poke the keys through the keyboard when they type, it was a little bit problematic when they started to play around with it. But yeah, you should do some typing. I liked it. I think it's a great keyboard.
Every time I get a new keyboard in, I set it on my desk for a couple of weeks and kind of use it on a normal basis and see what it's like.
Have you used a buckling spring keyboard, like an IBM Model M or one of the variants on that, anytime recently?
No, not recently.
It would be fun. You should track one of those down and do a comparison between them. Because I still think IBM Model M's one of the most amazing keyboards ever made.
Yeah.
But I would. Because I have like four of them in a pile back there.
Right.
So, oh my goodness. Acer debuts liquid-cooled Switch Alpha 12 convertible tablet. Does a tablet really need to be liquid-cooled?
No, liquid-cooled. They call it. So this is essentially a surface tap, right? Yeah, and it uses a heat pipe, or they call it the Space Age Cooling Acer Liquid Loop, I guess. Yeah.
No, what the rest of the industry has been calling a heat pipe for the last decade plus.
And it's essentially a competitor to the Microsoft Surface tablets, right? Like, it is a tablet with a kickstand that has a magnetically attached keyboard that looks really nice. I haven't seen it in person. It's called the Switch Alpha 12. It's fanless and has Core i3, i5, or i7 Skylake-based processors. And it's a 12-inch, 2160 by 1440 resolution screen, which I'm trying to, now I'm going to try to figure out what resolution that is. That's, what the heck is that? Does that math work out to? Aspect ratio of 1.5, so 3:2. So it's a 3:2 screen, I guess. So, okay, that makes a lot more sense now. But it looks like a nice piece of hardware. Little bit overkill on the branding or the marketing for the cooling, I guess. But,
well, if you're competing with Microsoft, you might want to, you know, erring to overkill on branding might not be a bad idea.
That's right. So they were trying to figure out a way to point out that it was fanless, and they had to use something more than just a heatsink, like it's a typical copper heatsink, to get it to be a fanless design, because even the Surface Pro 4 does have a fan in it. So And it's supposed to start at $599, but I don't know exactly what specs. I'm going to guess 128 gigs, 4 gigs of RAM, and the Core i3 processor would be a guess. So it's as guess as any.
If that sounded a little, you know, something, what Ryan just said, it's because we've seen a lot of companies launching expensive tablet lineups with an $800 safe configuration that's fundamentally a miserable user experience because, for example, it's running 4 gigabytes of RAM and a Core M processor or something. I've found that a little. Some of the entry-level machine specs are really deceiving. So you need to spend like $100 to $200 more to get something you would actually want to use on a daily basis. Don't run 4 gigabytes of RAM. At least 8. Please. Please. Speaking of shiny designs and marketing, HP announced the ultra-thin Chromebook 13. HP's on fire. This is a pretty Chromebook. 13.3-inch screen, QHD+, 3200 by 1800 resolution, all-metal case, 12.9 millimeters thick, 2.86 pounds, and they're promising up to 11.5 hours of battery life, and it's got 16 gigabytes of memory. So this follows the Pavilion Chromebook, the Chromebook 11, the Chromebook 14, and the Chromebook 11 G3, says the crew at VentureBeat. And apparently this is all about the enterprise market. Going to be available with a USB-C docking station, and the bottom configuration will start $500. You can order it now, but it won't ship until May 6th. That is by far the nicest looking Chromebook I have ever seen.
Yeah.
You know, I'm very curious to see what the Bang & Olufsen audio aspects of it. But if you're looking for a Chromebook, if you're looking for something, you know, that's going to keep the kids out of trouble or out of Minecraft or something you can send to that relative that you retired to doing tech support for. A lot of people I know have been really enthusiastic about the Chromebooks and have had zero issues in terms of reliability. And so it's the biggest issue with taking somebody out of a Windows or OS 10 environment and putting them on the Chrome OS is, you know, finding the applications they want. And usually people get into the idea of how they work pretty quickly. But that is a good-looking Chromebook, which it probably has to be for, you know, $500.
But, it's pretty pricey for a Chromebook, for sure.
Yeah. Well, that's probably why they're going for the enterprise market. So. Yeah. Speaking of not pricey, Amazon Basics single monitor display arm. I have a Dell monitor, which you can see right there. I should probably put something on that display to, you know, halo my head. But the base, one of the two arms of the base, legs, feet of the base broke. Not me, happily enough, that broke it. But it's incredibly frustrating. It's like, am I going to weld this thing? Am I going to sort of, you know, screw it down to a board? And single monitor, you know, it's funny, like, I don't know what happened, but I bought it. I swear it was priced for $35 when I bought it. and now it's selling, for $100, but, it's a VESA mount. It is, super easy to set up. It'll handle up to, I want to say 25 pounds of monitor, which is a lot of monitor, for anything but living room standards. I was, you know, it's the build quality was kind of spot on. Everything worked really well. And I've been using it on my workbench, and it has been super smooth and super easy. That's crazy. I'm looking at this, and I kid you not, I swear I paid $35 for it, not $100. So I'll have to figure out, maybe it was a gold box special. I didn't realize it. But if you're looking to salvage a monitor, or if you want to actually, it's amazing once you start using on a desktop or a workbench, the ability to move the monitor around to exactly where you want. It gets a little addictive to the point where I'm kind of half tempted to put one on my desktop. But we'll see how that goes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anything exciting coming up on PC Per that we can talk about, or is it all relatively hush-hush at this point?
Well, I'll have like I said, I hope to have the full review of the Radeon Pro Duo up on Friday afternoon at least, trying to get through all of that stuff. I'm going to be at a beach next week, I think. So
you?
Yeah, me. On vacation, not for a work trip or anything. I'm going to go on a 12-hour drive with my 10-month-old daughter, so we'll see how that turns out, I guess.
All I'm going to say is, like, leave right before bedtime, you know, and put her down in either put her down in this in the seat or transfer her to the seat after she's fallen asleep and drive for as long as you can while she's sleeping.
Yeah, we're going to leave Friday night at like 9 and do some of that, but I can't drive 12 hours through the night like I used to. I don't have the
I'm not saying 12 hours. Drive 3 or 4 hours, cuz
yeah, we're gonna go 4 hours and stop and then get up as early as we can and go the rest of the way. So that will be my next week. But it will be we'll have fun there. Other than the Radeon Pro Duo, probably we'll be looking at some different VR side of things in terms of performance and doing some more benchmarking on that with some other games. And then after that, we start getting very close to new GPU timeframes. And so then you may never see me again, and that'll just be the end of it until sometime in late June. We'll see.
And he was never seen again. And just to let you know, apparently I cannot read, but that was $100 for the Amazon Basic single monitor display mounting arm. I was just buying it. Well, the monitor I have is heavy. It's like 18.5 pounds, so I couldn't. It's coming together for me now. I too know the pain of a child that takes my sleep. The $35 arm would not support the weight of that monitor. I will say it's handling, even extended all the way, it's handling that monitor, which is pretty hefty with savoir-faire. So just laying it out there. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for listening to This Week in Computer Hardware. If this is your first episode, do us a favor. Go listen to more. We'd love to have you on here each and every week. Go to twit.tv/TWICH to basically get all of our episodes and learn how to subscribe and get more. You can tweet at Ryan Shroud or at Patrick Norton if you're on the Twitters. And, hey, we want to thank you so much for listening. I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Ryan Shroud.
We'll see you next week on Twitch.